by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot to cover. Things are exploding all over the country because of this George Floyd murder that we're calling it a murder. It looks very much like that. And we're in sympathy with his family, and we know that there have been police problems over the years. So we're not denying that that has been the case in the history at times. The police have visited some very, barbarian forces on individuals, both black and white and all kinds of others. But we're going to start off an interview that Robert Barnes had. He's the host of American Countdown, and he interviewed Jack Murphy that gave us and gives us during this interview some very, very good insights of what happened in Washington, D.C. During those protests there. So here we go with Jack. You'll hear Jack Murphy first, and then Robert Barnes will come in, and they'll start the interview. But it's a very, very insightful interview. Here we go now.
So it's important to realize that this is a decentralized war, and these are networks that don't necessarily line up and have the same members in each group. But what they are is they're opportunistic, and they're taking advantage of this moment in time where they have an aligned goal, and that aligned goal is to erode the power of the establishment. And they believe that they need to erode the power of the establishment because established power is white supremacy. White supremacy has always been oppressive. And there's only one way to free the black folks of America, and that is to end the white supremacy that rules our land. And so that's their theory, and that's how they're coalescing, and they're just taking advantage of this moment of chaos in order to enact their agenda as they overlap at this moment in time.
Welcome back to American Countdown. Up next, we'll be live with our guest, Jack Murphy, who has the best beard since ZZ Top, the author of the book Democrat to Deplorable, also the co-founder of The Liminal Order, and a new creator of an excellent podcast. You can follow him on Twitter, at Jack Murphy Live. Jack, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing great, man. Happy to be here with you.
So you've been out filming some of the protests in D.C. What have you seen and witnessed?
Well, the first night that I went out, it was really quite chill. It was just a long march through the city, and everything seemed pretty relaxed aside from them taking over, the interstate in the middle of the city. No big deal. But the second night, things really got crazy. It was really focused on Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. at 16th and H, right in front of the White House. And the police, it was Park Police and Secret Service. Instead of having like a barrier, like a physical barrier or a big fence, the police were actually the barrier that was protecting the White House and Lafayette Park from the rioters and protesters. Well, the protesters that turned into rioters. And so it provided a very intense flashpoint where the protesters could get right up in the face of the Park Police and the Secret Service. They could scream at them, yell at them. I watched people pull bricks up out of the street and throw bricks at the police and the park police there. And they would pull the barriers away. And whenever they pulled the barriers away, the law enforcement had no choice but to defend the perimeter. And so they would spray mace. They would drop tear gas and other things, fire rubber bullets and pepper balls into the crowd. I got hit right in the throat live on stream with something right in my throat. Thank God this quarantine beard protected me. That was just the protests, okay? What happened after that is where everything got really dismal. There were guys setting fires to buildings at 888 16th Street Northwest. They were taking dumpsters, filling them with flaming debris, and running them into the police lines. And then from there, things just degraded even further. They started to set fire to buildings, fire to trees. And I watched firsthand live on Periscope. I had hundreds of thousands of people watching, where I was literally 10, 15, 20 feet away from just hordes of people smashing windows, looting stores, stealing property, stealing merchandise, setting buildings on fire, openly disregarding all the instructions of the police. And when they finally decided, the police that is, to clear people out, that's when the flashbangs started. That's when the concussive grenades started coming. You know, those are really loud, forceful explosions. And they started just marching down the street and pushing us back. But what happened after that was that there was no law enforcement behind where they pushed us out. And so there was just a stream of destruction leading down 8th Street westward towards Pennsylvania Avenue. And they were just destroying everything that they could, smashing windows, picking up rocks, picking up bricks, setting fires inside buildings that they had looted. Luckily, the fire department and the D.C. PD were sort of close behind. And so the fires didn't get too out of control. But had they not, these people were intent on actually destroying the property, breaking in, stealing stuff, and setting the buildings on fire. It was a chaotic scene. It was nothing like I'd ever seen in D.C. And I've covered other Antifa protests. I've covered other, you know, conflicts in Lafayette Square before. I've seen Antifa and Richard Spencer and those guys go head-to-head in the park. But this was nothing like I'd ever seen in D.C. And things only degraded and got worse that night. And the next day was the day that Trump made his way to the church. And that was the day that, you know, there was allegations of tear gas being shot into the crowd. But from a guy who lives in Washington, D.C., I know one thing is for sure, and everybody who's listening who lives in D.C. knows this is true. The president and the vice president move around the city at all times. And if there is an instance in which the president's convoy is coming by, those cops do not play around. And everyone in D.C. knows you get out of the way of the police when the president is coming. So the idea that these were just peaceful protesters sitting there calm and just chill and singing songs is absolutely absurd. And if there was any chance that there was going to be a conflict between the protesters and rioters, and the Secret Service and park police and the president, you know, they weren't going to take any chances. People get out of the way. Everyone here knows that. That's what you do. You get out of the way of the president when he wants to come through. And when he wanted to come through to the church, that was his right, and I think it was the right thing to do. The rest of it was absolutely appalling. I feared for my city. I saw the destruction. It was like nothing I've ever seen before living here almost 30 years in D.C. And I'm just glad that I was able to be up front, get the video and broadcast it live, which got signal boosted by all kinds of people, yourself included. And I know that hundreds of thousands of people saw exactly what happened that night.
How much has the media coverage compared to what you personally witnessed been accurate or inaccurate?
It's completely inaccurate. You know, everybody wants to just, the mainstream media just wants to call it, you know, peaceful protesters being harassed by the police. But what I saw was exactly the opposite. I saw protesters and rioters antagonizing the police. I saw them trying to bust through the perimeter of the White House. This is the freaking White House, guys. You are not allowed to break through a perimeter of the White House. I saw them pulling away the fences. I saw them throwing bricks, lighting buildings on fire nearby, lighting trees on fire nearby. And I noticed that the PD, MPD, and the Park Police and Secret Service, these guys are well-trained, okay? And every time the crowd would swell in its energy, the Park Police and MPD would swell in their response. And most importantly, every time there was a conflict at the barrier, they had to make space. And the way you make space in a conflict like this is through weapon fire or for crowd control. And you do that to make space and buy time. And the only time I ever saw them do that was to repair and defend the perimeter. Now, the next night and the next few days, the law enforcement and Trump's team made a great decision. Instead of using actual personnel to man the barrier, they erected a giant fence. They bolted it together. They locked it together with chains. And there was just no way that people were going to be able to break through that barrier. And so the police were able to just step back. And step back and step back. And when there was no point of conflict, when there was no close quarter antagonism, and nothing for the rioters to attack as far as law enforcement. There was a very limited conflict at all. So I think that the display of force that was shown actually brought a semblance of peace, and it also was a great adaptation and a new tactic, a new strategy implemented by the Trump and team to reduce points of conflict and to take away the option for the rioters. Now, what they did throughout the rest of the city was also impressive. They showed an extreme show of force at all local monuments, important commercial retail districts. There was, I saw every agency I could think of. I saw DEA, DHS, FBI. There was Park Police, National Guard, Military Police, and DCMPD. They were stationed at key points throughout the city, and they didn't even harass the protesters or rioters at all one bit after that. They let us, I mean, I say us, I was just following the crowd. They let us walk right through military checkpoints. They let us walk through the city. They didn't do or say anything. The only conflict I saw was direct response to either a breach of the perimeter or destruction of property or otherwise, you know, violent felonies that were being conducted. And once the Trump team decided to change their strategy a little bit, like that, it reduced the conflict at the main zone there at Lafayette Square, which where Mayor Bowser eventually wrote Black Lives Matter and defund the police in big letters that you can see from outer space. And then what happened with the rioters that were still left in town was they adapted. So they adapted their tactics, and instead of staying focused on Lafayette Square, there were a number of explosions throughout Upper Northwest Washington, D.C. the next night. I reported on them. Others reported on them. And then the rioters moved out into residential neighborhoods. They terrorized a local market where I used to live. Tucker Carlson talked about it on his show. It's called Mac Market. It was the center of community. Everybody loved the guys that owns it, the Kim family. They lost a son years ago, and the community rallied behind them. But guess what? The rioters moved down the street. They destroyed the store. They looted it. They smashed windows everywhere. Every commercial district from the city center all the way out to Bethesda has been completely boarded up. Every retail center, every major store, every restaurant, everything's been boarded up out of sheer fear and terror that these people are going to be coming into your neighborhood and blowing up things. There were car explosions at 11th and M, which is nearby the White House. There were cars on fire all over the place. So while the Trump team did a fantastic job of diffusing the tensions at the main center there, Lafayette Square, the rioters reacted, and then they moved out into other parts of the city. And there's only one thing I can think of. Their goal is just to terrorize the local population. But what's interesting about Washington, D.C. is that it is the bluest, most liberal city in all of America, and the people that live in those neighborhoods are willing to endure elementary schools being broken into and glass shattered, their local markets and retail places being shattered, broken into, violence. They're willing to endure it because they believe that they're on the right side of justice by supporting this kind of crap. And for me, I wonder what is going to be the breaking point for these folks. When are they going to realize that no matter how much supplication, no matter how prone they lay on the ground, that the violence is going to continue, and it's going to come to them eventually. But they haven't broke. I call them the race Karens of Bethesda. They haven't broke yet, and we'll see. They're enabling most of this stuff. The white, liberal, upper middle class female of America is basically enabling this violence because they're the ones reading White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. They're the ones taking the reading list from the American Defamation League and sending it out to the PTA and telling their parents that they need to read these books to their children, and this is how you talk about race. We're experiencing a fourth-generation war. It's on all fronts. It's physical. It's mental. It's moral. It's information. It comes through the schools. It comes through the culture. It comes through the freaking video games my son turns on when he sees right there, boots up his Xbox, and it says, you know, Black Lives Matter. So this is everywhere in all times, and it may have subsided right now, but I am not looking forward to the rest of this summer because I think that this is only going to escalate.
And in that capacity, who was it doing it? Was it just like I noticed there was a Vice view that did a study of Minneapolis, and they were filming it. And it was clear to me that there were criminal gangs part of the operation who had even mapped out. They knew in advance where the protesters were going to go. They even had all their equipment ready to rob a particular Wells Fargo. So it showed to me that there was Antifa involvement, there were criminal gangs involvement, and then I have what I'd call opportunistic crimes. And that was where you'd sort of like the old broken windows. When somebody sees a green light to commit a crime, they figure, why don't I just loot a little bit of Louis Vuitton? Combination was it there in D.C.?
That is exactly right. So on the second night of the protests, before they erected the barrier, it was very clear to me that there were clearly Antifa members down there. You can tell because they're all wearing the same clothes. They all bought the same gas mask that they distributed through their Amazon links to their boys. They had like the pink respirators. You can tell they're carrying skateboards, and you know that they're organized. You can see that there would be a guy in the front line using a fire extinguisher to cover them and create a smoke barrier, and then from like 20 feet back they would throw M80s and rocks and bricks and stuff at the police. It was clearly organized and they had a strategy. Now that was one group. Now there was definitely also opportunistic thugs operating, right? Washington D.C. is known for its crime, although it's been going down over the years. It was once known as the murder capital of the world, so it's not unusual for there to be opportunistic thugs operating in the city. And the next night, you know, we could hear the explosions going off in Northwest. And, you know, it's sad to say, but in Northwest D.C., we know two sounds. We know fireworks because people light off fireworks all year, and we know gunshots because people like to fire their guns. Yep, that's the pink respirator right there. And this was not the sound of fireworks or gunshots. This was the sound of explosions and people maybe perhaps breaking into ATMs, people blowing up cars to terrorize folks, maybe just taking opportunity to, indulge the weaknesses of the MPD who had their attention focused elsewhere. So it's important to realize that this is a decentralized war, and these are networks that don't necessarily line up and have the same members in each group. But what they are is they're opportunistic and they're taking advantage of this moment in time where they have an aligned goal, and that aligned goal is to erode the power of the establishment. And they believe that they need to erode the power of the establishment because established power is white supremacy. White supremacy has always been oppressive, and there's only one way to free the black folks of America, and that is to end the white supremacy that rules our land. And so that's their theory, and that's how they're coalescing, and they're just taking advantage of this moment of chaos in order to enact their agenda as they overlap at this moment in time.
And how have the D.C. politicians either suppressed or facilitated this behavior?
That is such an interesting question, because D.C.'s mayor, Muriel Bowser, I remember when Muriel Bowser was a candidate for Ward 4 in Washington, D.C., and she stepped in behind Adrian Fenty. She had no qualifications, no reason being a council member, and no reason to become a mayor. So she's mayor of D.C. now, sort of by default, rating on Adrian Fenty's coattails. And she herself has done don't forget, Muriel Bowser was the co-chair of Mike Bloomberg's campaign. She had eyes on the VP position, right? She is basically Mrs. Stop and Frisk. That's what I like to call her. She has increased the budgets for the police in Washington, D.C. She has hired people who think that we should be cracking down on crime. And then when Black Lives Matter comes to town, there's a word for it. I'm not going to use it, but she, you know, gives in to Black Lives Matter, and she basically throws herself on the ground and says, hey, we're going to paint Black Lives Matter on the street, and we're going to say that we're a part of this and we support you. But then Black Lives Matter, they know better. They know that Bowser, she has been increasing funding for the police department. She's not going to defund the police by any means whatsoever. And they're calling her out on it. Black Lives Matter Twitter accounts I see have been calling Muriel Bowser out. I'm calling Muriel Bowser out from the other side. I watch protests go from the White House all the way down to the executive building, the Wilson building on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., where they protested right on the streets. So no matter what Bowser is doing, she's still losing, because she is Mrs. Stop and Frisk. She is Mike Bloomberg's lapdog. She wanted to be vice president with a guy who policed New York in a way that had never been policed before. And that is what she's all about. She's learning from him, from Bloomberg, And now she's trying to play like she's Black Lives Matter. And guess what? I don't buy it. The people don't buy it. Black Lives Matter doesn't even buy it. And to me, that's one of the more hysterical parts. Well, maybe the only funny part of all of this is watching her try to, give in, not going to use that C word, give in to Black Lives Matter, but still take it right up the rear, because she is just not genuine in any way whatsoever.
It's interesting to note that, he says that Bowser, their mayor Bowser, was actually, of course, she was involved with Bloomberg in his campaign. And so she's not a very good example. She cozied up with the Black Lives Matter and had that painted in the street and all that just to cozy herself up and just make it look like she was friendly to them and all this other. But according to Jack Murphy, that's not the case. We have coming up next an interview that Brett Barr had with Attorney General Barr that reveals where Barr is on these investigations of spying on the Trump campaign and all that. Here we go with this interview now.
Now to the second half of my interview with Attorney General William Barr. We begin this evening from the courtyard of the Department of Justice by continuing the conversation about the organized elements of some of the rioting and looting. Barr singled out Antifa yesterday, but also said authorities are seeing a, quote, witch's brew of extremist groups.
We have, you know, extreme right groups trying to look like extreme left groups. We have extreme left groups masquerading as extreme right groups. We have players on both sides trying to spin up violence. So it's a complicated situation.
But you expect that there'll be more arrest at the organizing part of it?
Yes.
Soon?
I can't put a time limit on these investigations, but I think we are very much focused on getting on top of these groups.
Turning the page here to the Durham report and wondering when that is going to come out. You're now a few months away from an election, and there's some expectation that there's going to be at least some bombshells in there about the investigation of the investigation into Trump collusion.
Well, I can't address expectations. I can say that even with the disruption of COVID and the fact that our court system has essentially been shut down for a few months, the Durham team has been working very aggressively to move forward. And as I've also said, this isn't being driven by producing a report. We are trying to get to a point where we can hold accountable anyone who crossed the line and committed a criminal violation. So that's, I think, would be the initial stage of a resolution of Durham's investigation. But I also think that there will be public disclosure and some form of report at the appropriate time.
From what you've seen, crimes have been committed?
Well, I can't say,
Well, can you paint a picture of what it looks like as far as the broad nature of it?
I think before the election, I think we're concerned about the motive force behind the very aggressive investigation that was launched into the Trump campaign without, with a very thin, slender reed as a basis for it. It seemed that the Bureau was sort of spring-loaded at the end of July to drive in there and investigate a campaign, and they really wasn't much there to do that on, and that became more and more evident as they went by, but they seem to have ignored all the exculpatory evidence that was building up and continued pell-mell to push it forward. So that's one area of concern. The other area of concern is that after the election, even though they were closing down some of it, as we've seen in the Flynn case, and saying there's nothing here, for some reason they went right back at it, even at a time where the evidentiary support or claim support, like the dossier, was falling apart. And it's very hard to understand why they continued to push and even make public in testimony that they had an investigation going when it was becoming painfully obvious, or should have been obvious to anyone, that there was nothing there.
You always get lumped in with being political, and you've pushed back against that, the characterization that you're the president's attorney. But as you get closer to an election, doesn't releasing this report and making it more at risk for
falling into that political bucket?
I'm sure there are people who might say that. I've publicly made clear that this does not involve looking at President Obama or Vice President Biden. I think the people that we're looking at are not at that level, and I think...
What names we would be familiar with?
Some of them. You know, here's the thing. For the first time in American history, police organizations and the national security organizations were used to spy on a campaign. And there was no basis for it. And the media largely drove that. And all kinds of sensational claims were being made about the president that could have affected the election. And then later on in his administration, there were actions taken that really appear to be efforts to sabotage his campaign. And that has to be looked at. And if people want to say that I'm political because I am looking at those potential abuses of power, so be it. But that's the job of the Attorney General.
If you had to characterize the Durham report as you know it now, is it going to be eye-opening for Americans, or is this going to be kind of a blip on the road to...
I'm very troubled by what has been called to my attention so far, but I'm not going to characterize it beyond that.
Can you tell us anything about the investigation into unmasking?
You know, unmasking is not by itself illegal, but the patterns of unmasking can tell us something about people's motivations at any given point of time. So we're trying to take a look at the whole waterfront on unmasking, what was done especially in 2016.
And is there criminal implications there?
As I say, it's not against the law to unmask anyone. But, I mean, for example, let's say suppose... for a period in the spring, there was a lot of heavy unmasking done on people involved with the Trump campaign. That would be very relevant as to what people were thinking at that time and what their motivations were.
You mentioned the Flynn case. You're in the process of trying to dismiss that charge, the charges, yet the judge Sullivan, continues on and has now a shadow prosecutor making a case that it should continue.
The argument is that it's always been understood that decisions whether to pursue an individual through the prosecution process or holding them criminally accountable is vested in the executive branch and not the courts. And he is essentially, in our view, trying to set himself up as an alternative prosecutor.
And so have you seen anything like this before?
I'm not aware of anything like this before, and I think that's why this is not being argued at the appellate stage in the District of Columbia.
I know you can't get into specifics, but the DOJ Inspector General identified this top FBI lawyer who fabricated evidence in order to justify this warrant against Carter Page to spy on him. We know that's a crime, yet there haven't been any charges yet. Is that person still working at the FBI?
No.
And are there charges?
Well, you know, we can't discuss, you know, future charges. But I have to say that I do find a little irritating, you know, the propensity in the American public on all sides of the political spectrum when they see something they think could be a criminal violation and say, why hasn't this person been indicted yet? Why hasn't this person died? Why? And, you know, there's the old saying that the wheels of justice grind slow, and they do grind slow because we have due process and we follow the process. But people should not draw from the fact that no action has been taken yet that means that people are going to get away with wrongdoing.
The president is counting on you and your department to crack down on social media platforms for what he calls censorship, including his own tweets. You said the law allows these companies to operate and it's been stretched beyond its original intent. So you think these firms are somehow censoring the president and his supporters?
Well, I think there are clearly these entities are now engaged in censorship, and they originally held themselves out as open forum where people, third parties, could come and express their views, and they built up a tremendous network of eyeballs. They with a lot of market power based on that presentation, and now they are acting much more like publishers because they're censoring particular viewpoints and putting their own content in there to diminish the impact of various people's views.
So is there some action that you're taking?
Well, we are looking, as many others are, at changing Section 230, which is a rule that provides some protection for these companies.
Which would require Congress.
Which would require Congress, yes.
Prisoner swaps with Iran have required the Justice Department to drop charges or agree to time served for defendants in federal courts. Is this a good policy when Iran arrests people for just being American?
Well, it's a policy that, you know, has to be handled with care, that we don't invite, you know, seizing of more Americans. But in the individual cases where we've done this, we felt the benefit outweighed the risk.
So it was worth it?
Yes.
More to come on that?
I can't say.
What is it like working with President Trump in the middle of these crises? It's two in a row now, and you've been meeting with him a lot.
It's good, because I think the president's very decisive person, and he's interested in hearing all the views. There's a lot of robust discussion, and he makes a decision, and I think he's been a good leader.
If the president is reelected, would you serve in a second term?
I'm not going to get into that.
You're not?
No.
But if he asked you, would you?
That would be presumptuous of me to discuss that.
Our thanks to the Attorney General and his staff.
Attorney General Barr keeps saying that they're getting closer and closer. There have not been any indictments. And some people are believing that they're just stalling this, which will take them through the election. So there won't be really indictments. They only have about 4.5 months to go before the election. So there are people that are very, very, you could say, pessimistic about how fast Barr is moving. Durham, he keeps referring to Durham. He has good, solid information. And there's some very, very frequently mentioned names that are very, you know what I mean, commonly known about, or you could say, that are being investigated. But we don't have any real deep-seated, you could say, knowledge of really what's going on. Next is Zagami. Harrison Smith interviewed Zagami, and Zagami is, Leo Zagami is a former possible Illuminati member, close to the Vatican and all the upper level. And he has some very, very interesting things to say about Pope Francis and his affiliation with liberation theology and the communist left. But here we go with Harrison Smith's interview with Leo Zagami. Here we go now.
Harrison Smith sitting in today for David Knight. It is June 10th, 2020. I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Leo Zagami. You can find his work at leozagami.com. And, you know, when the producers asked me, is there any guests you want for today's show? You know, I started thinking about it. I started thinking there's so much going on. There's so much going on behind the scenes. It's so crazy. Who do I want that is good at piercing the veil, that is good at sort of not getting distracted by the little problems here or there, but really has their eye on the ball and understands the greater picture of what we're dealing with? And of course, there's no other name that comes to mind more so than Leo Zagami. So thank you so much for being here with us, Leo, to shine some of your wisdom on what we're going through.
Thank you, Harrison, and hello to all your viewers.
So we were talking in the break. You have a lot on leozagami.com. And so I almost just want to hand it over to you and go, what are we missing here? What is going on behind the scenes? You're so good at knowing what these secret societies are up to, why they're pulling the strings that they're pulling. So I almost just want to say, what's happening? What is going on in the world right now?
I think that Archbishop Vigano made it really clear in his letter to Trump, which was sent a few days ago, and that shocked the world when he talked about the children of light and children of darkness. And he was also highly critical of the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C., the first Afro-American, who was installed coincidentally just 4 or 5 days before George Floyd's death. And so now this Wilton B. Gregory, who was installed as Archbishop of Washington, D.C., has become instrumental for the Catholic Church in their battle against Donald J. Trump. He went around showing his recognition and his nomination from the Pope. And definitely, it's very strange that the first African-American Archbishop of Washington, D.C., is nominated just a few days before chaos unleashes worldwide. And Archbishop Vigano sent this unprecedented letter that clearly talks about not only a deep state, but a deep church, which is a way of describing that the Catholic Church has been taken over by demonic forces, and we know also by a communist pope that acts like some kind of communist revolutionary, like Che Guevara. A couple of days ago, he apparently invited, with the excuse of an interview, an Italian broker in the Vatican, who was later arrested, and this is also quite unprecedented. He was arrested and is now in the Vatican prison. His name is Gianluigi Torsi, and all this is regarding that infamous deal that took place in London for Sloan Square, for this building in Sloan Square. So there is a lot going on behind the scenes, and then we have, of course, the confrontation between the British Crown and the DOJ regarding the possibility of interviewing Prince Andrew, who, of course, was connected with Jeffrey Epstein. So this is what is really going on, aside from, of course, Hillary Clinton, who has to eventually show up in September for her emails. Everything else is a distraction, but most of all is to create a class and a race war, which it's demanded to ruin the presidency of Donald J. Trump, and in one way or another, lawful or unlawful, pushing their candidate, which is Joe Biden, which is also the candidate of the Vatican, because he actually arranged for his nomination 1 year prior to announcing it, like we said here on InfoWars last year. So Joe Biden is really the candidate of choice of the Vatican and of China. And the Vatican and China are discussing a new unprecedented deal for September. They have been, of course, finally instating this unprecedented diplomatic relation at the beginning of this year in February during the Security Conference in Munich. And this September, they will unify their forces. The Vatican Archbishop in charge says that this church must be totally Chinese and totally Catholic. Now, totally Chinese these days means totally communist. So, here we see, of course, Pope Francis, which is definitely a hero of the left, and that's why he is also loved by the mainstream media. And it's quite scandalous what is happening also regarding the arrest of this broker, because they want to find an scapegoat for what they have done. And, of course, there is the involvement also of Cardinal Pell, who has been, as you know, released from prison. Mm-hmm. And we don't really know where he is, but we know that he's still very influential in the future of the Vatican Bank and of this money laundering that went through St. Peter's Pence. And this property broker is part of this whole deal.
Yeah, and you know, you bring up such an interesting point with China especially, because you know, this has been going on for a couple years, actually, where it was that same archbishop that you just mentioned saying the best place for Catholicism to exist is China, which flies totally in the face of the news reports that we're seeing of people in China, you know, churches in China having to take down their crosses and put up images of Xi Jinping. And yet you have the Vatican saying this is the best place for Catholicism to exist. So, and this was years ago. So all of these paths have been laid, and now we're just sort of walking down them, sleepwalking down them, largely. And as you said, the appointment of this archbishop in Washington, D.C., happening just before all of this happened. And then I thought one of the most amazing things from these riots is Donald Trump went and held up that Bible, beautiful, you know, image of this is a Christian country and you can't burn our churches down, only to be rebuked by the Washington, D.C. Episcopalian bishop, who, you know, when her church was burned, she put out one little tweet saying, it's fine, don't worry about it. And then when Donald Trump held up a Bible, she went off and, this is not right and you shouldn't do this and blah, 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 and, you know, went on and on and on about it. It was like she was angrier that Donald Trump held up a Bible than she was that her church was being burned down. So, you know, I've been talking this whole time about how our institutions from our government and industry have been captured, but it's religion as well, Leo.
And Arizona, when you actually showed that image, it says behind there, all welcome. And that Episcopal bishop, of course, ignored what is actually clearly stated. And in support of the Episcopal bishop, which is not Catholic, of course, then came the actual Catholic archbishop that criticized then Donald J. Trump's visit to the shrine of St. John Paul II, who is an anti-communist pope, who was an anti-communist pope, and the wife, Melania Trump, and him, they revered also very much the Holy Mary of Czechoslovakia, which is also considered anti-communist. So the statement that Trump made, he was invited at the shrine by the Knights of Columbus, who then got heavily reprimanded and criticized by the Catholic Archbishop of Washington, D.C., and even by a member of the Knights of Columbus, a black member of the Knights of Columbus, who should have never got race involved with this kind of business. Here we're talking about the fate of a human being, and it doesn't have anything to do with the color of one's skin. We're going towards complete insanity here when we have people like the London mayor Khan, who comply with diversity, is gonna now bring down the statues of important figures of the British Empire, just like is happening here in the US. So, I mean, all this shouldn't be encouraged. And then the Archbishop on Sunday, after Vigano's letter was sent down, and Vigano was very clear also in criticizing the Masonic element within his letter also. He criticized. And then there was the reaction of the
Archbishop. Tell you what, we got to go to break right now. I'm gonna read a little excerpt of that letter when we get back. More with Leo Zagami on the other side. Don't go anywhere unless you go to leozagami.com. You can go there. You know, the problem, ladies and gentlemen, with bringing a man like Leo Zagami on the program is that we only have 30 minutes. The man is too informed. Maybe if we had 10 hours to discuss all this stuff, we could get through it. But unfortunately, we're just able to give you little snippets of the truth, and you got to go out there and do your homework. You got to go to leozagami.com and read the information for yourself, because we just frankly don't have time to cover all of it. But I did want to read from this letter from his name is Archbishop Vigano, and you can find this on leozagami.com. I want to read this. He says, I believe that the attack to which, and this is a letter to President Donald Trump, he says, I believe the attack to which you were subjected after your visit to the National Shrine of St. John Paul II is part of the orchestrated media narrative, which seeks not to fight racism and bring social order, but to aggravate dispositions, not to bring justice, but to legitimize violence and crime, not to serve the truth, but to favor one political faction. And he says, what more effective way is there to combat this, Mr. President, than by prayer, asking the Lord to protect you, the United States, and all of humanity from this enormous attack of the enemy? Before the power of prayer, the deception of the children of darkness will collapse. Their plots will be revealed. Their betrayal will be shown. Their frightening power will end in nothing, brought to light and exposed for what it is, an infernal deception. So very powerfully said, and very powerful letter throughout, really laying out exactly what's going on here. So, Mr. Zagami, is this the answer? Just try to bring it all to light and let God work it out, because what we're up against is infernal in its disposition.
Yes, and who is saying that was actually the Vatican representative in the United States until 2016, nominated by Pope Ratzinger, and once even close to Barack Obama. So, I mean, he used to be somebody who was not really involved in politics, but rather in protecting Catholicism and Christianity. And that's what this letter is all about. It's about showing the world that there is a battle here, a spiritual warfare that is ongoing. So that's why I tend to to call it a spiritual warfare. When we think, for example, that in Nigeria, in the same period in which we had George Floyd death, there was Muslims who killed a three-year-old girl, and they actually hacked her head to death, and she was a defenseless Christian. And many other Christians have been persecuted, and the local clergy instead in Nigeria went around doing protesting together, marching for George Floyd, when they have instead the persecution of Christians that is a much bigger problem there in Nigeria. So, I mean, it's also about prioritizing. The children of darkness are prioritizing nonsense. They are prioritizing division amongst people instead than unity. And when Trump showed his Bible, he was making a statement against the Satanist of organizations like Antifa. And we have also talked in the past about the fact that Antifa is often connected with the Satanic Temple and other Satanic organizations. So it is about protecting Christianity. That was a church that was set on fire the day before Trump went there. And it's very significant also because it's the Church of St. John, just as the shrine of St. John, St. John Paul II. But there's always a John. Why? Because John of Patmos was the receiver of these prophecies that came from the future, a future right. in which everybody will have a mark of the beast, and that is materializing right now with people like Bill Gates who are imposing their vaccination nightmare on humanity. So it's all manifesting in front of our eyes, and we are, of course, shocked by how theology and intelligence can now be merging together in this new thing that they call in the Vatican Theo-intelligence, which is apparently very popular amongst the Jesuits these days. We are definitely fighting an unprecedented war here, where also information gets manipulated. It's instrumental for propaganda reasons, and that's why China is now using the riots to cast down an even further spell on their own view of America as the big problem for humanity. The big problem for humanity is not America, as we know, but is rather China, which is the dragon. I have interpreted China as the dragon of the apocalypse. So we are definitely in full swing with this end-time scenario. And as you know, Harrison, then we will, of course, have to interface obligatorily with artificial intelligence. And that's why China is doing all this, to become the leading nations of artificial intelligence. But artificial intelligence is simply a way, a gate, towards meeting Satan himself, because Satan himself is going to merge with the AI. And at that point, we will be, of course, in a real prison planet.
Coming up next, we have some information on the Capitol Hill, you could say autonomous zone out there in Seattle. We have not only the police chief, Carmen, but also there's some Jenny Durkin. She's the mayor of Seattle, puts her two cents in. Here we go next.
Encampment of sorts remains in place near Cal Anderson Park on Seattle's Capitol Hill. Events have been peaceful over the past couple of days, complete with cookouts, film screenings. Earlier today, Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best issued a message to the department telling officers abandoning the East Precinct was not her decision.
I want to update you all on the situation at the East Precinct. The decision to board up the precinct, our home, the first precinct I worked in, was something I have been holding off. You should know, leaving the precinct was not my decision. You fought for days to protect it. I asked you to stand on that line, day in and day out, to be pelted with projectiles, to be screamed at, threatened, and in some cases hurt. Then to have a change of course nearly 2 weeks in, it seems like an insult to you and our community. Ultimately, the city had other plans for the building and relented to severe public pressure. I'm angry about how this all came about. I understand that my comments in this message may be leaked to the public, but I'm not concerned about that. I stand by what I'm saying. We had solid information to believe that anti-government groups would destroy the precinct once we left, whether through vandalism or arson.
Again, Chief Carmen Best. King 5's Chris Daniels joining us now. And Chris, you asked Chief Best a direct question about those particular comments today. What'd she say?
Yeah, Joyce, the hastily thrown together press conference came just hours after Best made those comments. And a visibly tired chief reiterated again that she has not made the call on many controversial moves within the department.
For the tear gas, it was my decision.
Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best and the city's Mayor Jenny Durkin trying to show a united front.
You should know, leaving the precinct was not my decision.
Hours after the chief suggested she did not make the call to shut down the city's East Police Precinct.
But it didn't come from me. So, and we'll review all of it.
So command staff made that decision to close the precinct?
We're looking into all of it, Chris.
But Durkin said she's in no big rush to reclaim the spot, even though the chief said she wants to put officers back in the precinct.
It has been described by the president and others as what it is not. It is not a armed Antifa militia no-go zone. And we will make sure that we find some way for people to continue to protest peacefully while also getting ingress and egress.
Yet the mayor said she made the call to remove barriers, which had been the site of violent confrontations.
I think it was the right decision. I think it is clear that the removing the barriers was critical to removing the flashpoint.
It was all enough for an observer to wonder if the two leaders are on the same page.
Yes, I'm standing here, right next to her, giving the briefing. Yeah.
I have confidence in the chief. And we've been asked in other forums, are you going to resign? Is the chief going to resign? The answer is no and no. We thought about a Thelma and Louise moment, but that's not happening either. We are here. We got work to do, and we're going to get it done.
Again, no firm timeline today on resolving that situation up on Capitol Hill. I did have a chance to speak with Seattle City Council Public Safety Chair Lisa Herbold. She told me the city does need to, quote, start to begin the process to resolve it, saying, also quoting, I don't believe the situation as it is can go on forever. Hmm. Reporting live in downtown Seattle, Chris Daniels, King 5 News.
Well, Chris, let's talk about the future of the department, because I know that came up, too. There have been calls to defund the department, and the mayor talked about a reimagining of the department, but said there will be no massive cuts, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the question this week here at City Hall with council hearings over potentially cutting the funding for the Seattle Police Department. Durkin flat out ruled out a 50% cut in police staffing, saying that is not something that she can see doing. But she did, in fact, talk about potentially reimagining the department in the near future.
Here's an update from Police Chief Carmen on the Capitol Hill autonomous zone. Here we go now.
And we're going to start with the situation in Capitol Hill, Seattle's neighborhood. All eyes are on that neighborhood in Seattle and its leaders, especially Police Chief Carmen Best. Dozens of protesters have taken over the streets of what they're calling the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ. You've likely heard about it by now. Occupiers have the area near Cal Anderson Park barricaded. It all started after 2 weeks of protests that resulted in clashes with police and the closing of the East SPD precinct. What do protesters want? At its core, police reform. According to a list of 30 demands posted on Medium.com, their number one demand, defunding the Seattle Police Department. Chief Best yesterday visited the now boarded up East Precinct, renamed by demonstrators as the People's Precinct. And we're lucky to have Chief Best joining us now live this morning on King 5 Mornings. Chief Best, thank you for taking the time so early to join us on this Friday.
Good morning, Jake. Thank you for having me here.
It has been quite an historic week for sure. I'm just going to get right to it. What are the plans to try to take back the streets on Capitol Hill?
Well, Jake, we're still in the process of determining how best to make sure that we can safely address all the issues of the protesters and demonstrators who are there in the area right around the precinct. My goal, first and foremost, is to have the officers back in the facility. As I've talked about before, you know, our response times to calls for service have more than tripled for emergency calls, our priority one calls, and our response times for other calls are hovering at around an hour. So we want to get officers back into the precinct. That precinct stands empty. The taxpayers are currently paying for it, and it's really important that we're able to get back to doing the work that we're supposed to do.
You started at Seattle Police 28 years ago. That East Precinct was your first precinct where you started as a rookie cop. What message does it send, in your view, Chief, that you had to abandon that East Precinct? You said that it wasn't your decision, but what is the message that the city is sending right now?
Well, Jake, I don't use the word abandon. That was never our intent, to give away our precinct. But there were some safety concerns that precipitated moving the officers out for what would have been or should be a limited time. We're not abandoning that precinct, and our full intention is to come back to our space and do our work and make sure that we are answering calls for service and taking care of the community.
How do you get in there, though? I guess I'm curious about the tactics, because it's been a very hands-off approach, obviously, to getting back into that neighborhood. Tell us some specifics about maybe what you have planned today to maybe talk to these folks or just move back in.
Well, there are some real challenges there. I think that right now I know that we have some officers already in the building. The challenges are making sure that we can identify people who can actually participate in conversations on behalf of the demonstrators. It appears to be a rather leaderless group, and for that reason that makes it a little more difficult. But we want to make sure that everything is done peacefully. We want to not end up in a support situation or in a situation where anyone in the neighborhood, including the protesters, is any way harmed. So we're going to take it methodically and slowly to make sure that we can afford everybody the safety.
You know, I have to ask, Chief, I mean, everybody is watching you right now across the country. The president tweeting about Seattle, calling these folks domestic terrorists, saying if you don't take back the city, he will. Are these folks domestic terrorists, and how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, Jake, I always let the politicians do the politicking. I don't really get involved in the political arena. I'm the chief police chief. I really want to make sure that our officers get back into that facility so they can answer calls for service and not get involved in all the politicizing and the fray. Really, it's just about public safety for me. That's what I'm sworn to do.
Yeah, and we're seeing more video of those protests when your officers were in riot gear. Are you worried that that's going to happen again?
Well, we're certainly trying to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think people have made it very clear that the use of CS or tear gas should be limited, and they really don't want to see the streets, with that level of violence. And also, you know, the officers were taking rocks and bottles for a lot of that time, and I don't want my officers hurt either. So we want to make sure we provide for everyone's safety. So we're going to really modulate everything and make sure that any time that we have to act, it is proportional. And so we're hoping to make sure that everybody stays safe. So we'd rather take our time. I think it's our ally in this case.
Even though it is at the sacrifice of public safety, you made that clear that response times are increasing. Isn't that an urgent enough matter to try to move in even today, right now?
Well, it's definitely urgent, but, you know, not at the risk of, having some sort of standoff that ends up in a dangerous situation. So we have to balance all of that. It would not be worth the hurting, significantly hurting anybody on the scene. So we want to make sure that we are modulated, responsive. But yes, absolutely, we need to be back in that facility.
Chief, I know you're super busy, but I got another question for you. One story that stuck with me this week was this idea that Seattle police were no longer welcome on the school parking lots. Seattle Metro says police can't use the buses anymore. The University of Washington says they don't want to see your officers there on campus in many situations. How does that make you feel, this sort of sentiment that the public is turning on the police?
Yeah, it makes me sad. I mean, some of these organizations and places that you've mentioned, we've had a long history of partnership. But I think right now where we are in the country, and certainly locally, as a turning point where people really want to see some significant changes, and we acknowledge that. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to have that dialogue and that partnership, because actually we're all in this together. Nothing gets resolved unless we're all connecting, cooperating, and having these conversations. So it was very disheartening, but I believe that we're going to get through it, and that the partnerships, that is, will be regained.
Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best at a really historic crossroads here in the city of Seattle. Chief, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jake. You have a great day.
You too. Be safe. Michelle?
There are some real firebrands stirring up the protesters. There's a lot of hate and resentment because of the killing that occurred in Minneapolis. And so it's not hard to stir up that hatred and focus it towards some targets. But thank you for listening, and good night. God bless each and every one of you. Good night.